This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com.
Well, good afternoon, picnickers and history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. And in a gesture of unbridled generosity, you have a complimentary copy of the latest issue of History Ireland. Sticky, just test it, hot off the presses, right? Pick it up and smell it, right? It's a very good issue. This year is the 250th anniversary of the declaration of US independence. So the Irish-American relationship is very much in the news. The British claim to have a special relationship with the United States, but we claim a unique relationship, and exemplified by the now traditional bowl of shamrock in the White House on St. Patrick's Day. But what we want to look at here is it's a look at this relationship and to see, you know, has it always been cordial? What have been the ups and the downs? And to help us in this discussion, we have Dan Mulhall on my right here, our former ambassador in Washington. Dan was here last year, couldn't wait to get back for a second go. We've Michael Kennedy to Dan's right and John Gibney to my left. Again, both Electric Picnic veterans. You can see the boot on the mud on their boots. They're with the Royal Irish Academy's Documents in Irish Foreign Policy. And then finally, on my left, Bernadette Whelan, who has also, of a University of Limerick, who has also donned the wellies in previous years here to make up the rest of the panel. Okay, so what I want to look at first, guys, is the situation around 1919, 1920, during the War of Independence. Bernadette, could I go to you first, right? Because before we talk about the Irish side of this, what's happening in the United States? Obviously, the United States has just come out as the victor in a major war. Because of its geographical remoteness, it didn't suffer the physical destruction of other belligerents. President Wilson had enunciated his 14 points, promising self-determination for small nations. So surely this was an open door for the representatives of the Irish Republic. Anyway, what's happening in the US?
Okay, well, the first point, I suppose, is that what's called the Wilsonian moment wasn't actually a moment. It lasted about 18 months, but didn't last. It had a longer lasting effect, but not in the way that Wilson expected, or indeed that the Irish hoped would happen. So the Wilsonian moment really was this enunciation of what he called a principle, whereby the Americans would support the right to self-determination, in other words, to have an oppressed state could have its own government, indeed its own state, and that the Americans would support it, that Wilson's, one of his second points, that this international architecture, which would be created through what he called the League of Nations, forerunner of the United Nations, that would guarantee. It turned out that that was not to be the case, that in fact there was going to be self-determination promised only for the states of the empires that had been defeated. So there was immediate hope and expectation that Ireland in particular, but also Egypt, India, some smaller groups in South Korea, in China, they all hoped that they would get independence out of this new post-war settlement. And that's the Wilsonian moment. Those hopes were dashed very quickly. Huge sense of frustration, disappointment, etc., particularly among the Irish, who initially used their own early, nascent, very small diplomatic resources, and which Michael and John can talk to, in Paris in particular, to try and encourage Wilson to. And indeed, there was an Irish-American delegation there of quite high-profile and powerful people. And the hope was that would all encourage Wilson to allow the Irish to have a hearing, at least in Paris, you know, at the peace negotiations. And that doesn't happen. So in a way, the Wilsonian moment, that you might want to call it, what it does serve to do is to radicalise the Irish even more, to move from the path of diplomacy towards more militarisation, and in combination with other factors, towards the Anglo-Irish War of Independence. So I'll leave that to Tommy and hand it over to the others.
Okay, I tell you what, Michael, I want to go to you then, because Éamon de Valera arrives styled as President of the Irish Republic. So what was you know, the US government's relationship with this virtual republic, you know, De Valera? I mean, how did he get on? I mean, his object was to gain recognition for the republic. How did he do?
Well, it's mixed how he gets on, but the point to get across to you here is Ireland has declared its independence in 1919, January 1919, but there's no point in just declaring independence. You've got to have that accepted by other states around the world. You can declare you're a republic, but if it's not agreed to by other states, it doesn't matter a damn. So one thing De Valera goes to the states to do is to try and get recognition from President Wilson of Irish independence. But that's not going to happen because America at this stage is developing its special relationship with the UK. So it's not going to. Wilson is more interested in what's going on in London. And there are differences in the Anglo-American relationship over naval power and over who's the upcoming power in the post-First World War world. So De Valera really has his job laid out for him as he goes to the States in 1920. And I think what you've got to remember about this period is these are much younger men than the De Valera you might think of, the old man, the half-blind man with the, you know, the thinning hair. These are, De Valera is what, maybe in his 40s at this stage. The guys who are with him are in their 30s. And De Valera goes over fighting. He wants to try and raise money for Dáil Éireann to fund the new government in Ireland. He's trying to get recognition that I've spoken about. He's trying to unify the Irish-American community behind, which is split, behind what he's doing. And I think that the most important part of it all is that he undertakes a coast-to-coast tour. If he was here today, he'd be on the main stage. He was getting in huge crowds across the US who are interested in what Ireland is doing, not only the Irish-American community, but broader. And it's getting funding from them through the Dáil loan, I think, is the long-term impact of what he does. Politically, he doesn't get recognition. He doesn't unify the Irish-American community behind him, but he gets money. And that money goes over to fund Dáil Éireann, to fund purchases of arms during the Anglo-Irish War. And we might come to what happens, the rest of the funding, later on. So De Valera
and
the States
is mixed.
Michael,
I ask one question. Yeah. Was there any attempt made by official circles to stop him raising money?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay, so they didn't give him recognition, but they're all right letting him raise a few bars.
It's okay to get money into the coffers and get that back across, but getting weapons across and certainly recognition, they're things that aren't going
to
happen.
It had to be clever, though.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. So it's the personal mystique, I think, of De Valera as well that gets built up during this period. He builds himself up as President of the Republic and builds up a very skilled team behind him, many of whom, sadly, are lost during the Civil War, some of whom, such as Sean Noonan, go on to become, in years to come, in decades to come, Ireland's ambassador in the United States. So it's mixed, what De Valera.
Okay, so he fails on the recognition, but he wins on the fundraising.
Now, certainly,
There's one other aspect about this, John. I want to go to you, and this bears directly on the war, meanwhile, going on back in Ireland, because Dave also often gets criticised for swanning around the United States, while the serious work has been done back in Ireland by Collins and others and so on. But what's your take on that?
Well, for a lot of people in the Republican movement as it was then, they were supportive of the idea of him going over to the States, publicising the cause and trying to raise money. Because if he went back to the 19th century, pretty much any Irish nationalist or Republican movement worth its salt, whether the Fenians or the Home Rule movement even in its various manifestations, had a US adjunct that would raise money for them, that would generate publicity amongst the Irish community and the Irish-American community over there. And because this was in an era where emigration was still happening on a massive scale throughout the second half of the 19th century. So the Irish-American community would very often be Irish by birth. They weren't that far removed from Ireland by, you know, familial bonds or by the passage of time. So, and I should say, De Valera, as Michael said, he got huge crowds. He did a kind of a tour of many iconic US sporting venues, Wrigley Field. He got a crowd of 60,000 people in Fenway Park in Boston, travelled all around the States. And, you know, one thing, he was kind of shall we say, flexible about how he tailored his message. I mean, it's a famous image of him wearing a Native American headdress because he was in, you know, he was became an honorary chief of one of, I forget which particular...
Chippewa.
The Chippewa, yeah. But then when he went down to Birmingham, Alabama, he would give a speech where you might say Ireland was, you know, the last white nation still in bondage, you know, pandering to the prejudices of a southern audience. Now, his colleagues in the movement were supportive of him doing that because there was a sense that that's what you kind of would try to do. And to go back to Bernadette's point, when they had tried to lobby the post-war peace conference in Paris to recognise Irish independence, it was pretty obvious that was going to go nowhere. But the attitude shifted away from, say, trying to directly lobby a government. But if you tried to lobby and influence the electorates of a democratic government, so if there was a big enough community in a given country whose sympathy could be won to the Irish cause, then maybe that sympathy might percolate up into political action. And then there is, of course, the financial side of it as well. And it's a good. It was a good point raised about how do you raise money. Like, what was the way they raised money in the States was by selling what were called bond certificates, not bonds, which are sold by governments. And apparently this was done on due to legal advice provided by a young US attorney called Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So you call them bond certificates, you'd sell them, the money could be redeemed on the creation of an Irish Republic. And now there's a whole story as to what happened to the money, because not all of the money ended up back in Ireland supporting the Republican cause. A lot of it remained in US banks. But the point was, over $5 million was raised in the course of 1919 and 1920 in the United States. And just over a quarter of that money was raised in New York. So, you know, De Valera did get support of many, many, you know, significant figures in US political life. But it didn't make an impact at, say, the top echelon of the US administration. That's not to say it wasn't important. It publicised the Irish cause. And, you know, the followers and other, you know, activists in the movement at home, people like Michael Collins, Cathal Brewer, Austin Stack, these guys supported the idea of De Valera going around the States and actually trying to kind of raise money for their cause and also publicise it at the same time.
Now, I'm looking at the time here, guys. We have a lot of stuff to cover here. Now, the treaty split and civil war obviously had a disillusioning effect on American opinion as regards to Ireland. Bernadette, so it's true that by the 1920s, the United States had somewhat lost interest in Ireland, but the opposite wasn't the case. I'm talking here about the cultural influence of cinema and so forth. Just talk to us about that. That's a huge influence in Ireland.
Yeah, it is. I mean, in a way, the other aspect to that, what you might call kind of cultural transfer, is that Ireland, like many other English-speaking countries, was already becoming Americanized. It was heavily Americanized anyway, through things like film that begins to come in from 1910, the growth of Hollywood. You look at newspapers, magazines, as cinema going becomes so important. You know, there's more and more of the messages coming through about America. Now, a lot of those messages are seen as anti-nationalist, and there's a whole debate around modernity and what modernity is, and tradition. And of course, remember the new governments that come in 22 and then in 32, they're very much in favour of keeping a conservative Catholic society that is also heavily traditional in the way that they support, continuing support for the language, the Irish language in particular. And also, there's constant campaigns against Americanization, Los Angelization, as the first Irish censor called it. But in fact, while you have legislation that's introduced and regulation of cinema, as we know, of books and dance halls, at the same time, at another level, the level of the ordinary public, there's no change really in their behaviours. And people just get on with their ordinary lives. And one of the targets of a lot of those campaigns was, of course, young women and young females' behaviour, wearing mixed lipstick. They were seen to be more susceptible to things like jazz, believe it or not. Not young men. You were absolutely fine, but it was young women. So there are those kind of, there's that two levels really of activity that's going on. And Americanization, as Tommy says, it operates in different ways.
Okay, I want to move on to neutrality, but Dan, I want to come back to you first on this whole question of the reality of power politics, right? Because, I mean, Michael has alluded to it there, the reality that the United States and Britain were joined at the hip, militarily, diplomatically, every which way. And you're a man who's been at the coalface there. Yeah. So what's it like between being the meat and the sandwich here between these two great powers?
Look, it seems to me that the great achievement of De Valera and many others who made that journey across to the United States from the late 19th century onwards, when it became very easy to travel across the Atlantic. And like, for example, Douglas Hyde, when he was president of the Gaelic League, went over and spent 7 months traveling around America raising money for the Gaelic League. John Redmond raised huge amounts of money for the Home Rule Party. the Irish-American Clan na Gael, who were the Fenian movement in America, they sent vast amounts of money back to Ireland to prepare for the Easter Rising. And then after the Rising, you had the establishment of the Friends of Irish Freedom, which campaigned for Ireland and for Irish independence. So the great achievement of the Irish revolutionary generation 100 plus years ago was to internationalize the issue. Because if it had remained an issue of Ireland and Britain, no progress would have been made. But the fact that they were able to bring Irish America into play meant that the British government in London had to at least think that there might be a problem if they didn't do something to accommodate Irish aspirations. So while we didn't succeed in getting a hearing at the Treaty of Versailles negotiations, De Valera didn't get agreement from the American government to recognize his republic, but nonetheless, the noise that was made by De Valera and others around the world meant that the Irish issue became a subject of interest by the international community, and particularly in America, and it meant that the British government had to factor into its thinking the danger that Irish America could poison the wells for the United Kingdom in America at a time when America had become the number one power in the world, and therefore so, Britain had to take notice of what Irish America was up to.
So that the propaganda value like stayed the British's hands in Ireland in terms of the press security. Okay, I want to move on to neutrality, Michael, because Ireland was neutral in the Second World War, as was the United States, of course, until Pearl Harbor.
They were attacked.
Now, I mean, could this be described as the low point of US-Irish relations?
It could, but I want to come on to something that Dana said there, that it's the noise that Ireland makes in the period you were talking about. Britain is worried about that happening again during the war. So Britain tries to get the Irish-American community not to support neutrality. And I think that's trying to keep that noise down, trying to make Ireland look as if it's being immoral by being neutral. So then linking that into the low point of relations between the two countries, Ireland is unfortunate during the Second World War in that its ambassador in Washington is a provincial journalist, Robert Brennan, who is not able to get into the mindset of the Anglophile State Department. He's much happier with the Irish-American community. So where we need to get into that power politics that Dan was talking about, we don't have the clout in Washington to overcome the special relationship. And that's probably the low point of Irish-American relations, because we can't sell it to America that we are neutral until we are invaded. And that's the bit we always forget about neutrality. We were a lucky neutral, America wasn't. So we have to try to get America to understand our neutrality. And Brennan is not necessarily good at that. Now, neutrality doesn't necessarily affect America per se. There are American aircraft crashing into the mountains on the west coast of Ireland. America could say, well, we would like maybe more Irish support in the Battle of the Atlantic. But it's the problem is that it's the American ambassador in Dublin, David Gray, who's a relation of the Roosevelts, has an absolute deep dislike of neutrality. And so he poisons the relationship between Dublin and Washington in a way that if there was a more understanding ambassador there who could have said to DC, actually, there's a reason that the Irish are behaving this way. There are certain aspects in the past going back to the First World War period, going back to partition and so on, why Ireland is going to remain neutral until it's invaded. So yes, it's a low point. But
now, how credible was threats, US threats to invade Ireland from Gray? I mean, explain the context of that very briefly, Michael. Yeah,
in the run-up to D-Day, Gray gave a note from Roosevelt to De Valera saying, close down the Axis missions in Dublin. That's the Japanese, the Italian, and the German missions in Dublin. Dublin's take on this, the Defence Force's take on this, is that it's a pretext to an invasion to try and shut down Ireland in the run-up to D-Day so that no information escapes from Ireland that could let the Axis know that an invasion of Europe is planned. Now, it's taken incredibly seriously by the Defence Forces. It's the last time during the Second World War that Defence Forces units are sent into the field to take up defensive positions along the River Boyne and along other defensive lines north of Dublin. Now, you might say that's an absolute joke against the American Army, but remember, this is a generation who have only just got their independence, 20 years ago or so on. They're going to defend their country for all they possibly can. Any other country would. So the threat is taken very, very seriously, even if in the end it's a diplomatic ruse, really. But you can't take it at face value that nothing is going to happen, that America would not think twice about steamrolling over the border. It had been anticipated Britain was going to do this since 1940. And you can think Britain will take over whatever countries it particularly likes. It invades Iceland, takes over Iceland in May 1940 because it's in its national interest to do so. Hmm. America and Britain will act similarly.
Okay, listen, I'm going to look at the time here. I want to move on very quickly, John, to the 1960s, because things had transformed in the 1960s in the wake of JFK's visit. So what's happening there?
When?
No, I'm just saying that by the 1960s, how have things changed?
Well, changed since World War II.
From this low point.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you're going to have to go back to World War II for a moment to understand that. And it's, I mean, you know, we've been talking about this, about David Gray for a moment, but even aside from him, and even before the US entered the war, it was being made clear to the Irish government through various US emissaries, official and unofficial, that even before the end of the war, they viewed Nazi Germany as an existential threat, and they were prepared to back the British. And the message coming through was that, well, surely an existential threat to Britain or America is an existential threat to Ireland. That message was being brought through, and it's a little reminder that, you know, a big country like the United States will have its own agenda. You know, as every country will do, when we say Irish-Americans, sometimes we can dwell on the First World rather than the Second World. And it does seem to have been the case that, you know, like a huge amount of eligible Irish-American males, I mean, by eligible, I mean those who could enlist in the U.S. Armed Forces, something 44% of them would have enlisted during the Second World War in the U.S. military, which is a higher proportion than many other groups who might identify by a country of ancestral origin, you know, the Italians or the Norwegians or the Germans or whoever. So Irish America had invested in the war, and I suppose it was a general wariness of a country that had remained out of the war, whether or not that was understood or misunderstood or not. But the Ireland of the post-war era, of the late 40s and 1950s, was an Ireland that in some ways was quite isolated internationally. You know, like we left the Commonwealth in 1949. Now, whatever one might think of that decision, it was part of, I suppose, a grouping of countries, whether one likes it or not. That's the point, is regardless whether you think it's good or bad, we were a member of it. We didn't join the United Nations until 1955. So, and we never joined NATO, for example. So a lot of those kind of multilateral bodies that emerged in the aftermath of the Second World War, we stayed out of them, or it took a while to join them, and were quite isolated as a result. Now, there was, I suppose, and now Baron Dick can speak to the Marshall Plan, how that related Ireland far better than any of us could. But I suppose one thing to bear in mind is that we were seen as a Western country. And even if we were staying out of military alliances and so forth, that we were ideologically recognised as being part of the West, so to speak, within the Cold War, even if you were officially neutral. And I do think that kind of softened the attitude in the United States, or at an official level in the US, towards Ireland in the post-war era. Now, John F. Kennedy is a case in point. You know, came over here, the first Irish-American president. But his successor wasn't particularly sympathetic to or interested in Irish affairs, Lyndon Johnson, you know. So I suppose we were seen as part of the West, and part, if the chips came down to a war between East and West, the two sides in the Cold War, it was a kind of recognition that we were in one camp rather than the other, regardless of what our official position might be. And I suppose that kind of tempered things slightly. But in the aftermath of the First World War, there was a great deal of hostility towards Irish neutrality. And, you know, like, say, we mentioned De Valera earlier on. One of the most notorious instances of his career was, say, you know, the expression of condolences to the German representative in Dublin on the death of Hitler. One thing that's worth noting, but that is the outrage that provoked within Irish America. You know, the letters that were sent in that are in the National Archives in Dublin to this day, you know, lambasting De Valera for making that decision, and made by Irish Americans very often on the grounds that, you know, well, our sons and brothers were fighting in the war against this guy. How could you do that? So the hostility was there, but over time, I suppose, you know, the course of events would have tempered it slightly.
But he was goaded into doing that by Grey, is one point to make, that Grey's animosity was such in Dublin, he was persona non grata, they wanted him out. There's two quick points to make on top of what John is saying there as well, is that Ireland tries to get itself back into America's good books after the war. The Shamrock Ceremony in 1950 is a masterstroke in diplomacy, and that John Hearn developing that. And also, in terms of economics, Aer Lingus buys Boeing jets. That's important. And CIE buys its diesel locomotives from General Motors in Illinois. So there's an economic angle to that as well that's important.
Okay, I want to just move on to the troubles, the Northern Ireland troubles, Dan, because how did Irish diplomats counter the, quote, Northern Ireland is an internal matter for the UK? How did they counter that argument?
Remember, this is a general problem for Ireland. It wasn't just in America, right? Paddy Hillary in 1969 went across to London to sort of ask the British government, he was foreign minister at the time, ask the British government to sort of do something to stop the violence in Belfast, where Catholics were being attacked and so forth. And his counterpart refused to see him. He was seen by a junior minister. Jack Lynch instructed diplomats to go into the State Department. They went in and they were told, sorry, we can't interfere in this affair because this is a domestic matter for Britain. We're sorry, we're sympathetic, but we have nothing we can do. Go away. So the initial was a closed door in the face of Ireland. No one in official Washington wanted to hear about us. What you had then, of course, was Irish Americans started to become active, but in a very different way by supplying funding for IRA campaigns, which went on for quite some time. In the beginning, Irish diplomats had a really tough time in America because Irish Americans basically didn't want to hear the message the Irish government was giving, which is that we want to see peace in Northern Ireland, but violence is not the way to achieve peace, right? And it was a very difficult situation. And people had to go to these Irish American gatherings around America, and particularly in New York, and they would be jeered at and booed and intimidated because they were representing a government that was appeared to many Irish Americans to be too weak in the way it was responding to what was happening in Northern Ireland. So all I can say is that W.B. Yeats once wrote about peace comes dropping slow. And diplomacy is the ultimate slow bicycle race, right? You have to keep hammering away. Even when the door is closed, you have to keep knocking on it, looking for a hearing. And eventually, Irish diplomats, and in particular Irish-American politicians, started to get a hearing in high places in America for the argument that America couldn't just look away from what was happening in Northern Ireland, had to become involved. And the first American president to take an interest was Jimmy Carter. And I remember hearing Jimmy Carter talk about the pressure he came under from the State Department not to issue a statement on Northern Ireland. Now, the statement was completely anodyne, yeah. Simply saying that, you know, noting what was happening and that America would like to be able to help and so forth. It didn't say anything that ought to be controversial, but it was massively controversial. The British hated it, and the State Department did everything they could to stop Carter from doing it. No, but he did it.
Dan, I mean, I can just about remember that I'm very old.
I'm even older.
When Carter appointed the special envoy.
My
memory of it was a non-story in a way, because people wonder, what's that for? What's the significance? And it was like a ticking time bomb. Its significance became later. And I want to move on to Bernadette about this, Bernadette, because I want to move on to the 1990s, when all the stars come into alignment, if you like, in terms of overcoming this prejudice in the State Department
It was never fully overcome, by the way.
Bernadette. So, what has changed at this stage in the overall situation?
I mean, I think one of the key things, and Michael and John and myself are working on this project, and Michael and John are about to bring out volume 15 of the Documents of Irish Foreign Policy, which covers this period. And one of the things that comes very through in it very clearly is the extent to which this new generation of Irish diplomats in the US really understand the changing nature of American politics at the time, and how they, and Michael mentioned it earlier, how they recognize this and they amend their ways in a way in how to politic, in how to lobby. So they're dealing with not just with the State Department, as we heard there from Dan, but they also contact people like church leaders and important, not just Irish, but Irish-American, but American politicians as well, to try and get a broad base of people involved. So this new generation, that I would call them, who have this change mentality of Irish diplomats, they're key to what happens later on. And they are the ones who laid the groundwork for the Carter statement, for what happens with Clinton then later on. They also show their worth, and as does the Irish government, I think, as well, when you begin to look at things like arms running and raising money to send arms to Ireland. And they begin, one of the things we could see clearly in this volume 15 that will come out at the end of the year is that they are very clear that there needs to be an end put to the NARAID fundraising in the States that's been used to fund the IRA and their activities. So, as I say, there's a new mentality out there, a recognition of a changed America and Irish America. And for them, I think that all feeds into what comes in particular. I think the important one is not just Carter, as Dan said, but also the Clinton's a period as well.
Now, presumably the end of the Cold War is a major part to play here. In other words, the alliance with Britain is no longer as vital to the United States' own interests. So it completely changes the whole international situation.
Yeah, except that this, like the America, the British, and indeed, you know, there's that debate still going on there today. They still regard their relationship as unique, special, with Washington. So overcoming that and overcoming that evidence, as we talked about, of Anglophilism within the State Department, that's still there,
and that's hard to deal with. Problem is still there.
Yeah, look. A prominent Irish-American politician during my time in America said to me once, Danny said, he said, the British can get their way on most things in Washington except for Ireland. On Ireland, they're pushing a wheelbarrow up a hill, and it's very, because we'll stop them. So you don't need to have ranked masses of congressmen supporting your position. You need a smallish number of congressmen who are sufficiently committed to make sure that you get a hearing. And that's what I found over the years, is that we've managed to cultivate people in Congress. And remember, at the time you're talking about, there were the four horsemen. There was Senator Ted Kennedy, there was Governor Hugh Carey, there was Daniel Patrick Moynihan, and the fourth one was, there were four horsemen. Tip O'Neill. So these were powerful Irish-American politicians who had a standing in American politics. And, you know, Tip O'Neill managed to put pressure on Ronald Reagan, because Ronald Reagan was president, Tip O'Neill was a speaker of the House of Representatives, and O'Neill had a lot of power. And Reagan needed O'Neill's support on various things that he was trying to do. So O'Neill, and, you know, Reagan wasn't necessarily instinctively sympathetic to Ireland, but because of his friendship or his partnership with O'Neill, even though they were different political parties and miles apart in their politics, they still had to work together, and Ireland benefited from that partnership, and we got support, for example, for the Anglo-Irish agreements. And John Hume also deserves great credit for having gone to America and having kept going there, talking to people, gradually bringing people around, to the point where Bill Clinton felt it was an important thing for him to do, to send over somebody in the form of George Mitchell, unfortunately under a big cloud now, to chair those talks and to bring the Good Friday Agreement to fruition. And I remember being in Belfast in the weeks before the Good Friday Agreement was concluded, and the word would go around that the White House is on the phone. Imagine that. The most powerful man in the world was picking up the phone to ring these provincial politicians in Ireland to urge them to make that last move that was necessary to reach agreement on the Good Friday Agreement. And that was the importance of the American role at that time.
So, Michael, would you describe that as the Goldilocks period of US-Irish relations?
I suppose I would. And I'm personally biased in this, in that I was lecturing in Queens and Belfast at the time in the mid-90s. And it really felt different to have Mitchell across, to have Clinton. Like when Clinton came to Belfast in, was it 1995? I think, you know, we all got sent home from Queens for the day because the Secret Service were in, making sure that we weren't in, you know, hidden anywhere or whatever. But it was such a thrill to realize that it was all beginning to come right. So the stars are aligning, but stars don't just align like that. It's the fact that there is, for the first time in a generation, an American president who is interested in Northern Ireland. And I think that's critical as well. Perhaps also on the Northern Ireland side, there's the generational exhaustion in the Troubles, that after 30 years, it's time for peace, that things are moving in that direction as well. So it is a Goldilocks period, but personally I feel that, because having been there at the time as a very young academic and thinking, wow, the world, having grown up during the Troubles in Dublin and seeing the end of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, and it was a really nasty period, and you know, the Grey Steel atrocity at Drumcree, you had the chip shop bomb, and then all of a sudden things are beginning to go right, and it's in the world media. So personally, yes, definitely Goldilocks.
I forgot to mention at the outset that this is the History Ireland Head School. You're at school, guys. You're supposed to participate. Sit up straight in your seat and ask questions. So if anyone has a question here for the panel, Bridget there has a radio mic if anyone wants to intervene.
By the way, if you do have a question, I'll give you a packet of Cheez-Its, because I got given four of them earlier on. So that might encourage us.
Sorry, just Dan, on Ronald Reagan and his relationship with Tip O'Neill. And of course, Tip O'Neill was a major thorn in his side domestically, you know.
Of course he was.
But Reagan was giving a speech. Tip O'Neill was there, and he said, "Well," he says, "you know, we've a situation where the Speaker of the House is his major aspiration is to be ambassador to Ireland. Tip, how about tomorrow?" Anyway,
but by the way, the other thing was that Clinton sent Jean Kennedy Smith, who was one of the Kennedy family, and she, I think, played an important role as well during the 90s when she was in Dublin, in that she wasn't prepared to allow London to kind of, you know, keep her quiet. She had her own profile and she had her own relationship with the president, which she used to full effect, I can tell you.
Okay, so the result was the Good Friday Agreement, obviously a work of many hands, right? Now, Dan, because we're getting close to the end here, different situation today, right? I mean, we have the chaos of the Trump administration, and I chatted to you last year about this, and since we chatted, he has illegally invaded Iran, he has overseen the murder of his own people on the streets, he's threatening to take over Canada, Greenland, whatever. So does Donald Trump have any interest whatsoever in the Good Friday Agreement?
Well, look, what he has interest in is the fact that he owns a beautiful property, he told me, down in the west of Ireland. Doonbeg Golf Club, the finest golf club in the world, I think is how he describes it. No, look, he has a fondness for Ireland, because when he was developing that Doonbeg Golf Resort, he was well received. This was long before he entered politics, and he has good memories of the way he was received at that time, and so forth. So he's been an investor in Ireland long before he became a politician. So that's a positive, that's a plus thing for us. You know, does he know much about the Good Friday Agreement? No. I would say his knowledge would be pretty close to zero, right? But he understands that a lot of his supporters are Irish Americans, right? Because when you think about it, his support base is blue-collar workers. The Irish community in the United States are predominantly in that category still. And they're also based in the places where Trump did well, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and so forth. So he understands that the Irish have a certain value for him. And then the final point I would make is that the world has had a terrible time from Donald Trump over the last year and a half, right? I mean, you've mentioned some of the things that have happened, and it's pretty crazy. But actually, Ireland has gotten away pretty much scot-free, right? Because if you think about it, given our position on Palestine, we could easily have been targeted by Trump. We never have been, right? Given the trade surplus that we have, and Trump regards the higher your trade surplus, the higher the tariff we impose on you. Our trade surplus is off the scale, and Trump has never targeted Ireland during that 1.5 year period, right? I'm not saying we'll get away with this forever. I give credit to Micheál Martin as well for going to Washington and for somehow managing to build up a rapport with Donald Trump.
Yeah, but Ireland is being stood up like by far right circles. I mean, if you, in the media, it hasn't yet impacted in practical politics, but the arguments that are being made, you know, that we're a tax haven, that we're pro-Palestinian, blah, blah, you know, a whole list, right? And I mean, this raises the whole question: like, is Trump an aberration, or is he part of a longer term trend? John, what's your view on that?
Well, I better warn you is that this was I made a throwaway comment to him when he was coming up with the running order for this, and this has elevated me into an authority on Donald Trump. But I just want to make an observation about this, because when you look at Trump, and it's not okay, he's brasher than many of his predecessors. He's a master at playing the media. Like, any story about the United States is usually a story about Trump these days. He's catnip for journalists. But it could sometimes be suggested that he's some kind of this aberration that came out of nowhere and has kind of broken all these molds, etc., etc. A lot of that is true, but I do wonder about how much of an aberration he really is, because it reminds me of a line that the Irish historian Joe Lee said about Ian Paisley, that Paisley was best understood as a spokesman for Paisleyism. That he reflected a particular strand of life in the north of Ireland. And if it wasn't him, someone else would be articulating it. And, you know, maybe Trump is simply a spokesman for Trumpism. Like, he's reflecting a strand of life in the US that is probably as old as the US itself. And, I mean, last week, I don't know if anyone's ever been to a place called Tully Cross in Renville in Connemara. It was out there, good stuff. Do you want a pack of Cheez-Its? Get one at the end. It'll be multiple flavours. But there's a church there, well worth going into. Has a couple of lovely Harry Clark windows. It also has a plaque for somebody from the locality killed in the 9/11 attacks. And we're coming up to the 25th anniversary of them at the moment. Now, if you remember 9/11, you will also remember a US president called George W. Bush. And at the time, it's fair to say Bush may have been one of the most hated men on the planet. But I think back to Bush's presidency, and you think of the creeping authoritarianism that accompanied it, the deep social conservatism that was being articulated, the willingness for the US to throw its weight around. Now, I know, you know, Trump is perhaps not using the military. He's not embarked on, well, as much as Bush did. But certainly in terms of trade, you see the US trying to flex its muscles against rivals it perceives. And I come to wonder, is Trump simply part of the logical evolution of the US Republican Party rather than a flash in the pan? Now, time will tell, but it looks to me that, you know, what he represents is not going away. And if you look at the kind of people who seem most likely to succeed him in that role as a leader of the US Republican Party, he's not an aberration. Maybe just the way things are going, and we might have to reconcile ourselves to that.
Bernadette, what do you think? I mean, is he an aberration? I mean, with your knowledge, background on the evolution of the American political system, I mean, is it straining at the edges now? I mean, will it be able to handle this?
Well, I think it has to handle it. And I think already we've seen signs within the judiciary in particular of them being able to survive. Again, like John was saying, I preface it by saying I'm not an expert on Trump except what reads in the newspapers, which isn't always the real story. But I think the issue which John is saying, which is you can see the origins of parts of MAGAism within the Republican Party, and they're writ more large now, but they were there and they've always been there. It's just that now they've been given, in a sense, free rein. There are those other concerns, though, which are those links to big multinational companies, and particularly tech companies, their influence, which is a kind of an insidious influence on society, as we're just seeing at the moment with the current case, the Meta case. So there would be serious concerns there about the future.
There's a question there.
Okay, I'd just like to go back to, you mentioned that Irish Americans make up a significant portion of the Trump voter base, and going back to the Woodrow Wilson period and Irish Americans potentially protesting against Woodrow Wilson for his stance on an independent Ireland. Do you think that Irish Americans, by virtue of their Irishness, are still a Trump voter base, or is it more just they coincidentally? Because I've been to America and I've met a bunch of Irish Americans, and I don't know. I don't know if I'd characterize it as much as it being associated with their Irishness that they would be associated or not with Trump. Do you guys see Irish Americans as still a voting bloc in America, or how has that changed?
No. Look, I mean, they couldn't possibly be a voting bloc because they're scattered all over the country. They're in every walk of life you could possibly imagine. They vote as Americans. But that doesn't mean that they don't have, from time to time, an issue that will galvanise them, which will be supportive of Ireland. I remember once, when I first arrived in Washington, I was talking to a prominent Irish American. He said to me, "Oh, Dan," he said, "you know," he said, "during the Troubles, we knew what we could do for Ireland, but we don't know what we could do now." And I said, "Let me give you a little hint." I said, "Brexit's coming down the tracks. That's where you can be helpful to us." And in fairness, Irish America galvanized themselves during the Brexit crisis. You had the ad hoc committee for the defense of the Good Friday Agreement, which basically lobbied Congress and the administration to make sure that nothing would happen as a result of Brexit that would compromise the Good Friday Agreement. And that was an extraordinarily, and by the way, Jake Sullivan was a member of that group, and Jake Sullivan went on to become Joe Biden's national security advisor. After Biden came in, he sent the counselor from the State Department, Derek Sholley, no Irish connection, but working for Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State, basically to go over to London to tell the British, don't cause trouble over Northern Ireland. We have enough trouble on our hands already with Ukraine. We need to stick to stand together. We don't want you falling out with the UK. We don't want you falling out with the EU over Northern Ireland. Do a deal. And that, I think, was probably a very effective bit of pressure that came from Washington to sort of cajole the British into not breaking up with the European Union, not causing a serious problem over the Northern Ireland issue.
Dan, can I just bring you in there? I mean, what about the closeness of the whole MAGA project with the likes of Nigel Farage, the Brexiteers? They're very closely aligned, right? I mean, and there's a prospect that Nigel Farage might be the next British Prime Minister. That has receded somewhat after his financial problems.
Look, I mean,
he'll be standing in by-elections for the rest of his life, it looks like. Anyway, what's your comment on that? Because that's a big worry, surely.
Yeah, look, I mean, we can't foretell the future. Things can happen. And I think diplomacy and politics is about dealing with things that happen and finding ways of navigating your way through them. And, you know, like if Nigel Farage becomes British Prime Minister, that would be one hell of a problem for the Irish government. And nothing to do with America, but just to do with bilateral relations. But at the end of the day, the government, whatever it is at that time, will have to find a way of dealing with Nigel Farage. And likewise, in the United States, we don't know how the US is going to evolve. But whatever happens there, we've got to just try our best to make sure that we stay on the right side of things and that Ireland benefits from the relationship with the United States and doesn't lose out unnecessarily because we haven't plugged in properly to what's happening in the US. US is evolving all the time. We've got to keep monitoring that evolution, and we've got to try and keep in step with it so that we don't end up having our relationship with the US become a liability rather than an advantage. At the moment, it's still an advantage, although there's potential for it to go pear-shaped. But at the moment, we're still deriving significant advantage from our relationship with the United States, both politically and economically. But that won't last forever. We've got to be ready for changes that are coming down the tracks. We don't know what they're going to be, but we know they're going to happen.
A question for Dan there. Looking at 2028, and last year you mentioned three potential candidates from the Democratic side, Wes Brown, Josh Shapiro and Gavin Newsom, I think were the three frontliners. Are they still frontrunners?
All I would say there is that 2 years before Jimmy Carter became president, nobody would have imagined Jimmy Carter as president. He was an obscure Georgia governor, a peanut farmer from Georgia. 2 years before Barack Obama became president, nobody would have imagined that a man like that with so little experience could become president. 2 years before Bill Clinton became president, governor of Arkansas, very obscure kind of politician, all three of those became presidents 2 years later. So all I'm saying is that watch out after the midterms in November. You'll start to see people coming out with an offer. And all the people who now have in mind running in 2028 are currently working away with their advisors to come up with a platform of ideas that they can present to the American people and seek to win the election on that basis. I still think if I were a Democrat, I'm not involved, of course, at all, but if I were a Democrat, I think I would favor a governor over a senator or a congressman, because governors have a better handle on what's happening in the real world because they actually have to govern their states, and therefore they have some of the skill sets you need to become US president. And they're also better at campaigning because they're used to going around their state and talking to regular people, and they understand more about the economy of their states, and therefore are better able, I think, to articulate a policy platform.
Michael, I'm going to throw the final question to you. Will the unique our unique relationship with the United States endure?
Absolutely it will, because we have history behind us on this, and we have reason to maintain that relationship going forward. And thinking through what we've discussed here, Ireland's relationship with America has been at its best when we're plugged in. I think Dan used that comment. So having good diplomats on the ground who are picking up all of good sensors, picking up all of what's happening at grassroots, that will enable the relationship to maintain. We have permanent interests in Ireland as well as permanent allies. And I think America ticks both of those boxes for us. And we have to keep our wits about us. Something, maybe it was Dan said it to me on a previous occasion, is that the Irish diplomatic service is small enough and our apparatus in the States small enough to be nimble, to respond to the various changes that happen in the environment in the US. And so for that reason, I think it will stay important to us, because we are still culturally, socially, politically, personally connected to America in a way that we are not with many other regions of the world, perhaps with the UK, of course. Now, that will change. Australia may be another area. But I think the relationship will still remain hugely important to us geopolitically and in other ways as we develop forward.
Okay, I'm going to wrap it up there. Just to say that this was the History Ireland Head School. There's a number of head schools coming up, by the way, over the next few weeks, coupled at the Dublin Festival of History, and their website just went live yesterday. Now, Dan will be back with you 6 o'clock. Dan was saying he couldn't predict the future. But Dan, you're on a panel divorcing the superpower, the US, Europe, and the next 250 years.
No problem. We're on my future thinking cap in the next hour and a half.
So we've looked at the last 300. Dan's going to be looking at the next 250 years in this tent at 6 o'clock. So listen, thanks very much for your attention, and hope to see you all next year.